Of the Saturday evening to you, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, the host of the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, and this is a Saturday Night Special episode. Saturday Night Specials come along when I have something to share with you that isn't a regularly scheduled episode of the show. I always schedule them to drop at 6:59 p.m., because that's 1859 in military time, and 1859, of course, was the year our state was founded. This particular Saturday Night Special is a recording of a radio appearance on The Wake-Up Call with Bill London and Gary Snyder, the morning show on KPNW Radio, 1150 AM and 93.7 FM out of Eugene. KPNW has been kind enough to give me permission to rebroadcast it on my podcast, and so I am doing so now. By the way, I'm kind of a regular on The Wake-Up Call. I'm on the air with Bill and Gary once a month, usually the first Friday of the month at 6:30 AM. And if you happen to be around Central Lane County with a working radio, set that sucker up and rip the knob off, as they say. If not, you can always catch me on their stream by going to kpnw.com and clicking the red Listen Now button at the top right. This episode aired on May 8th of 2024, and the topic was a remarkable episode in Prineville back in the early 1910s, in which one of the most notorious Wall Street wolves, I guess you could say, came to town to get his daughter and son-in-law settled into their new home and found the local baseball team losing a grudge match due to some shifty dealing by the other team. Was our boy going to stand for that? Nope, he was not. He was going to bring his Wall Street wiles to the table and see what he could do for the Prineville Nine. It's a great story. So we're going to talk about it, and then I'll tell you where you can get more information about it afterwards. Here we go.
That music. And that can only mean one thing. It's a visit Woo-hoo. From the Finster, Finn John, yes. Calling from his official palatial professor's office at Oregon State University. What?
Good morning.
Good morning, Finn.
Yes, indeed. Indeed it is. It's a historic moment, too.
Oh, it's historic?
Yes, because I probably am about to get run out of the 15 club on a rail covered with tar and feathers.
Why?
Because I have some poetry to recite.
Oh, poetry. Mm. Finn John yeah. poetry. Okay, we're ready.
Oh, actually, it's not Finn John poetry. It was actually the poet is Ernest Lawrence Thayer. I just ruined it. That was my role.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Should we get to it?
Yeah, how did you ruin it?
Huh? The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Prineville Nine that day. The score stood 9-0 with but 2 innings more to play. When at the stretch the visitors relaxed and did the math, they knew the game was in the bag. It would be a bloodbath.
Wow.
That's all I've written. The rest of it, you know, writing poems is hard work.
Oh, did you write that, or did somebody else write that?
Okay, so that's the first 4 lines of Casey at the Bat, which is an 1880 poem, which is somewhat famous. I mean, baseball fans all know it. It was originally the Mudville Nine, and the score was 4-2, and yeah, but what I did was I kind of adapted it because the story of Thomas Lawson's $1,000 bet on the Prineville baseball team in 1910 really reminded me of Casey at the Bat.
Okay.
So I took some liberties that probably would have gotten me a cease and desist order if the source material weren't quite so old.
Okay, fair enough. So who is this guy?
Should I explain some more?
Yes, please.
Okay, so picture this. It's the summer of 1910, and Prineville and Silver Lake have got this sort of like Ducks-Beavers kind of rivalry thing going on with their two baseball teams. And they've come together in Prineville to get this decided once and for all. Who's going to get the bragging rights as the greatest Central Oregon baseball team of all time, or at least of all 1910? And it's not going well for Prineville. They're in the middle of losing the third game in a best-of-three series. They're down 9-0, and they're at the seventh inning stretch, right? So they've got, like, what, 2.5 innings left to play?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a real hard time putting 10 on the board in two innings against a team that they're down 9-0 against. And you may be wondering, you may be saying to yourself, or maybe not, but how on earth did Prineville manage to lose so badly to a, you know, if they're evenly matched enough to have a rivalry game going, you would think that they're not like blowout class.
Right.
But here's the thing. When Prineville showed up for this tournament, the first of the three series ended up in an unexpectedly brutal loss at the hands of the visitors. And the Prineville fans started noticing that none of their friends from Silver Lake were actually on the team. They were all people they didn't know. And then somebody recognized one of them and realized that Silver Lake had actually gone to Portland and hired ringers. They'd gone to Portland and booked a company of mercenaries to come in and take the field of battle for them.
Wow.
Well, I mean,
good thinking.
This wasn't exactly breaking the rules, because nobody had really thought to make a rule about that, right? Why would you go to that trouble and expense for? But apparently in Silver Lake, it was important enough to actually pass a kitty and hire a baseball team. And Prineville's collection of amateurs, you know, these are cowboys and shopkeepers, and they played ball on the weekends for fun and to keep in shape. And all of a sudden, they're taking the field against these like actual professionals who paid the bills banging baseballs around. So that's the first game, just a blowout. The second game, Prineville manages to rally and squeaks out a win. Well, of course, we know why that is. The professionals wanted to be paid for three games and not for two, so they let Prineville win this one. I mean, it doesn't say that in the source materials, but I mean, I would bet heavy money that that's what happened. But a win was a win, right? So now the series is tied up at one each, and the winner of the third game is going to clinch the trophy. And now back to our poetry moment. We're most of the way through the third game. There's a very little doubt about who that winner is going to be. Now all the Silver Lake folks had to do was coast through the last 2.5 innings without giving up more than 10 runs, and you know, Prineville was ready to have a fork stuck in it. But there was a complication. You see, there was a stranger in town, a visitor from back east, a dapper, well-built, prosperous-looking gentleman of about 50 in an expensive, well-tailored suit with a really fat wallet, which he had dragged out and gotten $1,000 out of. And, right, $1,000 in 1910 was heavy, heavy money.
Yeah.
It was a drop in the bucket of this guy's wad. His name was Thomas William Lawson. His name may ring a bell to some of our listeners. I suspect, Bill, his name rings a bell to you, and you probably have figured out why and are being very kind not to like spoil the surprise. But Thomas William Lawson, he had made a considerable fortune speculating on copper mines on Wall Street. And today he was hoping to augment that fortune just a tiny bit more by speculating on the outcome of this baseball game. Well, I mean, he could afford to lose his $1,000, but he would very much prefer not to, for reasons that we'll get into. And he also had a plan in mind for maybe changing the odds around a little bit more. Now Lawson was a somewhat famous man and actually quite infamous as well. He was basically a reformed Wall Street shark. He had run away from home when he was 12. He was a carpenter's son, and got a job as a bank clerk in Boston, where he saved up his salary and used it to speculate on the Boston stock market, specializing in copper mine shares. That would have been around 1870, so it was already becoming clear to everyone that copper was going to be the most important strategic metal of the age. For all of the technology of the 1880s and 1890s, So Lawson specialized. He made sure he understood all about copper, and with that knowledge, basically traded his scanty holdings that he got from his salary up into a pretty solid position, so that when the copper boom of the 1890s hit, he was ready to go. And within a year or two, he was a multimillionaire. And the 1890s were very good to Lawson. But in 1899, he went a little too far. He became the point man, the public relations face of the gang of financial thugs responsible for the first amalgamated copper incident. There were several, actually. But the first one was in 1899, which is when Amalgamated Copper was created, and it was probably the most notorious stock market swindle of the Gilded Age. It was a pump and dump, basically. And yeah, if the name Thomas Lawson has been striking you as oddly familiar for some reason that you can't quite put your finger on, this might be why, but it's probably for another reason, which I'm going to circle back to in a little bit. But for the Amalgamated Copper job, Lawson, the way it worked was Lawson teamed up with notorious robber baron plutocrats William Rockefeller, brother of John D. Rockefeller, and Henry Rogers, who was another Standard Oil guy. And the three of them formed an empty shell company called Amalgamated Copper. And through it, they bought an option to buy Anaconda Copper for $37 million. And then they got busy whipping up a public feeding frenzy over the shares of Amalgamated, which was still just an empty shell, by representing the deal with Anaconda as already done. The idea was to use the proceeds of that feeding frenzy to exercise the option, and then everything would be Jake. That feeding frenzy, that was Lawson's contribution to the project. Unlike Rogers and Rockefeller, he had a good reputation on Wall Street, and people who didn't trust the other guys at all would trust Lawson. So he told them to buy as many shares as they could, and they did. And this probably would have worked out great for everyone involved, but as the shares in Amalgamated Copper rocketed north of 175 a go, someone, probably Rogers or Rockefeller, figured out that the stage was now perfectly set for a pump-and-dump operation of historic proportions. So just before the deal was complete, when Amalgamated was still just a shell with no assets beyond that one purchase option, they leaked the word out that, hey, you know what, Amalgamated doesn't really own Anaconda yet, and there's no reason why we might not just shut it down and keep all the money instead of exercising that option. Yeah, thanks, everybody, suckers. Well, the result was a catastrophe for all of the smaller investors who had poured their money into Amalgamated as the shares plunged below $30, and investors who were able to hang on and ride the storm out were fine, because the value was there, but a lot of investors were not in a position to do that because they had borrowed money to increase their position. So, yeah, many of them had done that, too, because Lawson had been promoting it as a fabulous opportunity, which it kind of was if they could have trusted them not to blow it. He'd been telling everybody he knew for weeks that they were the best, most sure-thing investment opportunity he'd ever seen. He told them to go their limit. Many of them did. So he was in charge of the pump part. The question, the $100 question, is did he know about the plans for the dump? And he claimed not to, and those claims do ring true. His reputation was completely burned in this fiasco. Nobody in the investment community would ever trust him again. He did make a bunch of money by following his own advice and going his limit, buying on the dump dip, but that would be the last money he'd make on Wall Street. But it was kind of a swan song. It pushed his net worth to over $50 million, which is about $1.9 billion in 2024 dollars. And that's a pretty decent wad. It's certainly enough to be able to afford a $1,000 bet. But, yeah, a few years later in 1904, because he basically retired after that, and he was haunted by feelings of guilt over his part in this. And a few years later, he tried to redeem himself by writing a sort of a confessional called Frenzied Finance, which ran as a series for two solid years in Everybody's Magazine and sold magazines like crazy and made Henry Rogers and William Rockefeller hate Lawson as much as he already hated them. But, you know, he settled into life as a 45-year-old retiree on the 1,000-acre grounds of his magnificent mansion, which was right next door to the Kennedy estate. And, yeah, must be nice, right?
Yeah.
But, of course, yeah, an uneasy conscience. But now, right, it's 5 years after that, and he's in Prineville, Oregon, of all places, watching the baseball team that he's bet heavy money on getting, you know, its butt handed to it. So, okay, so what was Lawson doing in Prineville anyway? actually, he was there to buy a nice country estate to give to his daughter Dorothy and son-in-law Hal as a wedding present. He just happened to be in town with Dorothy and Hal on the day of the game, and they had just closed a deal on this gorgeous 640-acre spread on the Crooked River, and no doubt he kind of thought, you know, we'll put a little money on the home team to help warm up the welcome that they'll get in their new hometown. Well, Lawson could sure walk away from the $1,000, but, you know, he didn't want to let Dorothy and Hal get off to such a lousy start in their new hometown. So, yeah, Thomas Lawson basically knew exactly what to do, because the situation was fairly similar to some public relations challenges that he had faced down on Wall Street. So he decided it was time to go down to the field and do in the visitor's bullpen what he had done so often in his younger years on the trading floor, which basically was to persuade a bunch of young fellows to make bad life decisions. Bad for them, good for him. So this jovial, charismatic stock promoter, the chief salesman of the biggest bamboozle of the Gilded Age, smiles broadly and makes his way down to the Silver Lake players where they're resting and catching their breath. And no doubt he was at his boisterous and hearty best as he stepped up to the members of the ball club. The records don't mention that part. They don't mention whether he had anything in his hand either, like a bottle or bottles. All they mention are his words, which were, "The drinks are on me!" So, an hour or two later, at the end of the ninth inning, the final score was 10-9 Prineville. Silver Lake, yes indeed, they had lapped up enough flammable spirits to impair their gameplay, and Prineville had been empowered to go ahead and win the game. And of course, Lawson had run up a bit of a bar tab, but he'd also won some money to pay it off with. And his family's full and enthusiastic acceptance by Prineville community was a done deal, which was good. And not just for the newlyweds either, but for the entire state of Oregon. And that is because of the other reason I mentioned why the name Thomas Lawson or Thomas W. Lawson, Thomas William Lawson, might have rung a bell in your memory, because of Lawson's grandson, Dorothy and Hal's second child, who was named after him. And his name was Tom William Lawson McCall. And he grew up to be probably, in my humble opinion, the best and most effective governor in Oregon state history. So, yeah, that's Governor Tom McCall's origin story, sort of. Are you guys still there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm just,
no, no. You know, we got disconnected 20 minutes ago, Finn.
I've just been sitting here talking to the wall.
Did Tom McCall ever talk about any of this publicly?
You know, I'm not sure. I got this information out of his biography that Brent Waltz wrote. I'm blanking Fire at Eden's Gate, Tom McCall and the Oregon Story. Great book. That was 1994, I think he wrote that. There's also a little bit about it in The Copper King's Daughter, which is Dorothy Lawson McCall's book.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, this family was you know, East Coast aristocracy kind of thing. They had this huge 1,000-acre estate by Cape Cod called Dreamwald, and there's still a huge tower that's part of it still around today.
Really?
But Hal was very interested in, you know, Wild Wests and cowboy stuff, and came out to Prineville looking for a community and must have liked what he saw. Huh. Can't blame him. I love Prineville. I wonder if he was a rock hound. I also occasionally wonder if the family's path ever kind of crossed that of Klondike Kate, who we talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Recently. Another Central Oregon legend.
We got about 50 seconds left, Finn. Before we let you go, give out your website, because I feel like people should go there, because your website is so awesome.
Offbeatoregon.com. And I've got an evil scheme I'm going to try and get into YouTube videos, but don't hold me to that, because the technical aspects are hard. But that's on my summer project list this summer.
Don't tempt Bill.
All right. Finn, we'll talk to you next month. Hang on the line here a second. All right.
Thanks, everybody.
All right. Finn John on the Wake Up Call. It's News Radio 1120 KPNW.
Well, that wraps up this Offbeat Oregon Saturday night special. Thanks again for tuning in. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. You've been listening to a recording of a radio appearance on KPNW Radio's Wake Up Call with London and Snyder, The Morning Show. You can find out more details about the story I was talking with the boys about by going to offbeatoregon.com, clicking the blue directory button at the top right, and scrolling to May 5th, 2024, or searching for it with hashtag keyword. Hashtag Prineville9 will take you right to it. That's Prineville followed by N-I-N-E, not the number. By the way, if you've checked out my other podcasts that I started doing early this year, the Penny Dreadful Radio Hour, thank you. If you haven't yet, I hope you will consider doing so. I have been having a thundering good time doing that podcast, and every week I dope out new ways to make it more enjoyable of an experience for everybody. Basically, I'm rotating through a roster of 6 classic Penny Dreadful scandal story papers from the 1840s and 1850s in London. The Crimes of Sweeney Todd, The Adventures of Highwayman Dick Turpin, The Ballet Girl Melodramas of Rose Mortimer, stuff like that. Check it out when you can. It's a 1-hour show. It drops on Saturday nights, and I predict that you are going to enjoy it thoroughly. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. You can check out more about them at atlasstringband.com. Regular episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Unless, of course, you stream. Either way, it'll be ready to go before you know it, and until it is, go out and fill up the rest of the weekend with good stuff. Bye now!